But they could be very numerous. In the region of North Africa, which is a highly prosperous part of the Roman Empire, at the height of the Roman Empire, there were some 600 cities in that part of the world at that time. Many of these cities were, in the eastern half of the empire, were already existing places. This is part of the world, of the Roman world, that had a long heritage of urbanization. And so many of the places in the eastern half of the empire were cities before the Romans came. But in the western half of the Roman Empire, the situation was one of largely unurbanized pattern of settlement, tribal cultures living in villages, for instance. And it was in the western half of the empire then that the Romans did most of their founding of new cities. Most of these cities and towns grew up around military installations, forts and fortresses and camps established at various points as Rome expanded across new territory in the west. And they were linked together by, of course, the famous Roman roads, which were originally in their function military, designed to channel the soldiers effectively to the front. But as time went on and the empire became more stable and peaceful and the threat of foreign war, especially in the second century, largely receded, the roads, of course, then aided and abetted in the peaceful working of the Roman economy and the trading of goods across the empire. And the roads are really lifelines between the cities. What must be appreciated is that especially in backward parts of the empire, large tracts of the empire are wild country, wild back country, occupied with wild animals, entirely uncultivated, and also occupied with wild people. You'd have brigands and pirates in profusion in these hilly, mountainous, marshy parts of the empire. So parts of the empire like Thrace are up on the borders of the Danubian provinces, could be fairly wild and rough places. And the cities and the roads that connect them are like little oases of civilization, and they're sort of agricultural territory around them, and then the arteries of connection being the roads among them that sort of link them together, and then much of the territory then elsewhere being fairly wild and woolly. And this is what made travel so dangerous. When you went out on the roads travelling between cities, you usually had to have an escort, because otherwise you risked being picked up by brigands. As we've looked at earlier, brigandage being one of the chief sources of slavery in the ancient world. The city itself would have a wide variety of interesting inhabitants. There would, of course, be the local citizens, people who owned farms in the territory of the city. There would be the local aristocracy, people who owned estates or larger farms in the territory of the city. Some of the local aristocracy would be of equestrian status. They'd be sufficiently rich to qualify as knights in the Roman social hierarchy. They would be important people in their localities. If they could have sufficient property qualification and the status of a Roman knight, then they would be people who would be especially prominent in their local communities. As I've mentioned, perhaps a senator would own an estate in the territory of a big city, and that would also be a very useful thing, since the city could establish a patron-client relationship with the senator as a whole. The community as a whole could become the client of that senator, and then use the senator to represent that particular locality's interests with the central government, or perhaps try to tap his purse strings for him to build some local buildings or restore buildings or so on in the township. Of course, not every town or every city would have had a senator living in the territory, but some of the more important places certainly did, as evidenced from literary and epigraphic evidence. As well, there'd be a constant traffic of travelling hucksters and axters and soothsayers and tonic sellers and astrologers and doctors and all kinds who would be travelling around the empire peddling their trades. And you'd have various visitors passing through the city. You could have non-citizen residents, people who'd moved in from elsewhere and were applying their trade, perhaps as craftsmen in the town. And of course, let's not ever forget the large quorum of slaves that would be both working in the town as domestics and in a commercial capacity in the town, and also working the estates and farms around the place. So altogether a very vibrant and diffuse sort of a social environment in the cities. In terms of the administration of these nerve centres of Roman civilization, the pattern tends to be reproduced all across the empire in a very similar way. The form of local municipal administration tends to be fairly similar. Where the Romans encountered an established civic organization, they would let it stand. So in the Greek East again, these Greek cities would have had long heritages of having local officers and popular assemblies and councils and so on, and the Romans simply let that system continue to operate on the model, I suppose, of if it ain't broke, then don't fix it. If it worked for them, then it'll continue to work for them. But in the western half of the empire, where they had to found very many of the urban centres, in that part of the empire, a certain uniformity tended to creep in. And the general model that was used in shaping the administration of the local townships was the broad republican model of ancient Rome itself. Local townships had, first of all, a town council. We've already mentioned these guys. They're called decurions, and they were considered an order, an ordo, in the Roman system, and often referred to themselves in inscriptions simply as that, the order of the town. And these would be a group of wealthy local landowners, often with a property qualification determined by local circumstances for entrance into the order, established by law, by local law that is, and they would sit in a council, a senate-like council, and debate matters of local importance and make edicts and decrees concerning just the locality. Rather like the Roman Republic, the councils also had magistrates attached to them, annually elected magistrates, and these would be elected by a popular assembly, another feature of both the Roman Republic and the municipal authorities. So this is where your local citizenship kicked in. Your local citizenship allowed you to take part in local elections and voting for local magistrates. Again, the local magistracies of the Roman West even are very varied, but they tend to boil down to some similar forms, even if the terminology differs from place to place often. And those are two local headmen called duoveri. They're almost like small town consuls, and modelled again on the consuls of the Roman Republic. It's like a joint mayorship, might be a good way to think about it. And their chief duties would be to maintain order and justice, to hear out local cases in case of dispute between whose sheep is that, or where is the boundary between this orchard and my field. That's exactly what the local magistrates would be taking care of. You wouldn't bother the emperor or the governor with that sort of detail. That's precisely what the local towns were supposed to see to, just that sort of small town dispute. So then these two local magistrates, the duoveri, would take care of local justice. And often there are aediles below them, men who take care of the marketplace, who look after the fabric of the town and put on games, all in the locality, directly modelled here on the Roman Republic. These four, the two duoveri and the two aediles, were often elected annually. And we've also had evidence from inscriptions of local dictators, quaestors, prefects and censors. So all this terminology evidently creeping in to local civic administration from the Roman Republic. What's interesting about this is that even under the principle, even when the Roman Republic itself had been transformed into an autocracy, the republican model of local governance was maintained all across the western provinces, right up into the 3rd century and even beyond. There are town councils and local magistrates being elected by local popular assemblies. It's sort of something of a paradox that whereas the, it's not so much a paradox as an irony, whereas the central authorities had lost the republic in favour of a monarchy, it was the local authorities where there were still popular assemblies going for local elections. And when we look at the electoral posters, the paintings on the wall of somewhere like Pompeii, in which the plaster has survived on the outside of some of the buildings, which is very rare, of course. Well, there we see all kinds of electoral slogans painted up on the wall, which indicates that local political life was really quite vibrant and varied. The remains of the cities all across the Roman Empire are so numerous as to boggle the mind. It would be impossible to do anything like even a significant segment of them in the survey here. So all I want to do in this next section of the lecture is take the example of Pompeii specifically, which is a particularly well-preserved town and can stand as something of an exemplar for the physical appearance of these Roman cities. The Roman cities, by and large, from Syria to Scotland, had pretty similar sorts of forms. Even the Greek cities of the East gradually began to adopt many of the forms from Rome itself. Rome, of course, always been the model for all these cities, wherever they were to be found in the Roman Empire. And there's clear evidence of architectural influence on the Greek cities from the Roman West as well, in terms of the creation of fora and so on, even though the Greek cities had, before that, their own particular form and distinct shape. So using Pompeii then as an idea, as sort of a model for what a Roman city was like, the first thing we notice is that the actual nerve centre of the city itself was the place called the Forum. Usually all the roads from any of the gates of a Roman town would lead you to the Forum. If you just walk straight, you would eventually show up in the Forum itself. In Pompeii, the Forum is to be located in the southwest area of the town. It's a large open piazza with various public buildings dotted around its perimeter. All the public buildings serve a function and indicate to us the centrality of the Forum in the life of the city. The Forum itself, then, the actual open space of the Forum, is also something that was put to use. This is where, during market days, various booths and farmers' tables would be set up selling their goods and wares. And around the edge of the piazza at Pompeii and in many Roman fora was a double portico, a two-storied portico allowing people to walk around up above. Shops often located up there as well. So you actually had a two-story portico going all the way around the side, also offering shade and an opportunity for people to just loll and look at the world go by, look at the business in the Forum. Also, the open piazza of the Forum was used in early days for the staging of spectacles and gladiatorial spectacles. So another important public gathering space, another important function of the open area of the piazza. Also, of course, then the two-story portico, giving people a chance to get a good view of the action from above. Turning first to the religious buildings that are to be found around Roman forums, generally speaking, in Pompeii and in most Roman forums, the centerpiece, in the case of Pompeii, it's at the north end of the Forum, is the Temple of Jupiter, often called the Capitolium. It's usually a temple of some prominence, sometimes dedicated not just to Jupiter, but to the so-called Capitoline Triad of Jupiter, his wife Juno, and Minerva, the Roman equivalent of Zeus, Hera, and Athene, respectively. This is then a temple to the national god of the Roman people. And the fact that temples of Jupiter are reproduced all around the Roman Empire was a sign of the loyalty of the people to the Roman state and the importance of Jupiter as the guardian deity of the entire Roman Empire. Often the temple of Jupiter is a prominent entity right at the head of the piazza of the Forum, as it is at Pompeii, at the northernmost end of Pompeii. But Apollo was also an important deity to the people of Pompeii, so he had a very significant temple on the west side of the Forum at Pompeii, with a large enclosure around it. And, of course, the worship of the emperor was an important matter, so across the piazza of the Forum, on the eastern side of it, was the temple of the genius of Augustus. Not a temple of Augustus himself, but a temple of the spiritual essence of Augustus, that which made him great, that which made him who he was. So we can see just there, just looking at the temples around the Forum at Pompeii, that the Forum of a Roman town was an important religious centre where most of the religious festivals would have ended up, where the processions would have come down through the town, ending up at the Forum for sacrifices on various important holy days of the year. The Forum was also the judicial centre of the town, and to that end we often find near a Forum, and certainly at Pompeii, a building called a basilica. In the case of the Forum at Pompeii, it's in the southwestern corner of the piazza, and it's basically a large open hall with a tripartite division of columns that divides the hall into three regions, with a large dais at one end where the sitting magistrate would, the local duovir, would sit in judgment on cases of local importance. This is also where, probably on those occasions when provincial governors would be touring around their provinces, this is probably where they would sit to hear more important cases. Not necessarily in Pompeii, since Italy wasn't the province of the empire during the high imperial period, but in provincial cities out in Spain or Gaul, the basilica would probably be the place where the local governor, the provincial governor, would hear cases of wider importance as well, if he came visiting. So we have religious and judicial functions. We also have economic functions. I've already mentioned the piazza being used itself for booths and tables during market time, but sometimes permanent markets are to be located in and around Roman forums. And in fact, at the Forum of Pompeii, two of them are to be found, one up close to the Temple of Jupiter, and a second large prominent building erected by the priestess of Venus, Eumachia, with an extremely impressive frontage. It has a marble full-lined doorway indicating the importance of this particular building. And it seems to have been a large, recessed and enclosed special market for wool sellers. This is what the evidence would seem to indicate. This is a wool sellers market and a special area of the Forum demarcated for them. And finally, of course, the forum, besides its religious, judicial, and economic and social functions, it also was the political nerve center of the Roman town. Here is where we would find the offices of the various magistrates and the town council chamber itself, called the Curia. And in fact, the offices of the local magistrates at Pompeii are located on the southernmost end of the forum at Pompeii. So then all around the forum are grouped all the buildings that indicate to us the absolute centrality of the forum in the organization and in the running of the city and of the territory attached to the city. I should point out, of course, that these forums are replicated all around the empire. We have examples, for instance, from Duga in North Africa, very impressive remains there with a large open piazza and a fine Capitolium, a fine temple of Jupiter, Juno and Minerva dominating the whole open piazza. Or a very interesting example from a place called Soufeytla, also in modern-day Tunisia, where the Capitolium is not a single building but three temples side by side, the central one to Jupiter and then the flanking ones to Juno and Minerva. So rather than even having a single building, there's three separate temples, one to each of the Capitoline triad, giving this forum a very imposing form indeed. Despite the uniformity that I've mentioned, the fact that these forms crop up again and again and again around the empire, we mustn't think of every Roman city being identical. It had the same sort of elements in it. Fora are found pretty much everywhere. But there were differences, of course, regional differences in artistic taste and design and architectural forms and so forth. And a good example would be Ephesus in the Greek East, a magnificent site and one well worth visiting in Turkey. And some of the buildings there, just looking at the forms of them, you can see the magnificent, almost Baroque level of decoration that was popular among the eastern half of the Roman Empire. Magnificent architecturally carved decoration on the entablatures and capitals of the columns. Fine, fine detailed work of a sort that one finds extremely rarely in the West. So let's not get the impression that Roman cities and towns were all absolutely uniform in their appearance. They had similar elements, but there was certainly considerable cultural divergence in tastes and aesthetic tastes, architectural forms and so forth, as you moved around the empire. These have been studied by scholars as well. In addition, of course, to the public areas, there are all kinds of public amenities as well on offer in the cities, and we'll be looking at some of them when we look at entertainment and public leisure in the next couple of lectures. But you'd have taverns and snack shops, basically pubs, you'd have public latrines, all kinds of places of entertainment, theatres, odeons, amphitheatres, public bathhouses, gardens, areas for relaxation, fountains, a whole variety of areas and zones of amenity that were found in the cities, but not elsewhere. Most people in these cities would have lived in apartments. The rich would, of course, have had large townhouses, but most people would have lived in apartments. Certainly in Rome, apartment blocks could be quite large. They could reach as high as five stories, and they lived in a model that, in fact, most people in many continental European cities still follow. Most people in Germany and France in those cities still live in large apartment blocks rather than in smaller townhouses in the suburbs, the way people do, say, in North America or in Britain or Ireland. So the pattern of urban living in continental Europe is still relatively close to the ancient Roman model. The public buildings of a community of a Roman city reflect and were considered to reflect the majesty and dignity of the community as a whole. And they were erected either at the expense of the local decurions of the local order, who would vote public money for, say, the erection of a new temple of Jupiter or a temple to Augustus or whatever, or they were erected, as inscriptions tell us again and again and again, by local wealthy individuals who shelled out from their private funds for the public benefit. This process has been studied. This sociological phenomenon has been studied closely and is called euergetism by modern scholars. That basically means benefaction, the act of doing good. And it seems to have evolved over the course of the Roman Empire. Its roots are traceable into the Greek past, but it was really very prominent in the Roman imperial period. It seems to have evolved into a sort of a social contract, whereby the local bigwigs were expected to erect public buildings, or restore or extend existing public buildings if they've fallen on hard times, or to give games, or to give banquets, or to stage spectacles, on even on some occasions to have occasions where people just got cash handouts, just the guy showed up with money and just handed money out to people. These were all features of, again, living in a city that were very specific to Roman urban culture. And this process of euergetism, this social contract of euergetism, is one of the most fascinating aspects of that. It's worth remembering that when you travel around these sites, if you ever get a chance to go, you must think that nearly all of these buildings are a product of private munificence for the most part. Because even the Decurions, when they were voting to erect a building, would pool their resources, as the local bigwigs, would pool the resources together and then use that, calling it public money, they would then erect. Because basically taxation was extremely rudimentary. It wasn't anything like as developed as we have it in our modern world. So the system of euergetism then was something of a social contract, allowing the upper classes to provide the lower classes and the city with the buildings, the public buildings that manifested its dignity and so reflected well on them as the local important people. And of course, buying for the people who gave up their money for the public benefit, buying for them that which was most important to the Roman status and respect. Because the inscriptions were erected, stuck up on the buildings, and many of them survive for us today to read. That's how we know about the whole process. So the cities then were absolutely the nerve centers of the Roman world. The city's forum is where the 9-day market would take place. All public elections for the officers in the local community would take place in the city's forum as well. Important religious festivals, though some of them definitely took place out in the countryside, would also wend their way towards the city itself, usually ending in the forum. All kinds of public entertainments, spectacles, theatre events, and the like were to be located in the cities. Judicial functions would also be served out in the cities themselves. And the cities were, in many ways, almost like leeches, draining the resources of the surrounding countryside to feed the city occupants, whilst also providing all these services and amenities for the people of the territory. Perhaps the most striking symbol of the centrality of the city to Roman culture are beyond the roads which link the cities are the systems of aqueducts that often feed large cities. Rome itself had, in the 3rd century AD, 11 aqueducts. Between them ran for over 300 miles and brought in the region of 180 gallons per head per day into the city. And many Roman cities like Carthage have very impressive aqueducts in their hinterland, bringing spring water past the fields of the rustics. You must remember this, you're out toiling in the field as a farmer and there's water is going right past you, straight into the city, for use usually in the public baths, so that the people in the city could enjoy their leisure time. And the remains of, say, the aqueduct at Carthage, stretching for over 60 miles, extremely impressive remains indeed. But I think the aqueducts, as well as the roads, are an apt physical manifestation of the superiority in the Roman mentality of the urban centre over the surrounding countryside.
Lecture 42, Public Entertainment, Part 1, The Roman Baths and Chariot Racing.
Hello and welcome to the 42nd lecture in our History of Ancient Rome, in which we're going to examine the public baths and chariot racing. We're going to devote this lecture and the next to a very characteristic feature of Roman society, one that was unique to Rome among ancient societies, which was the development of a true culture of public leisure and mass entertainment provided through the euergetistic process as we examined in the last lecture. It was regarded as an essential part of the euergetistic contract, of the contract of benefaction, that the upper classes provide entertainments and what were broadly called the conveniences, our comforts, the commoda of the mob at their own expense. This was done on an enormous scale by the emperors, and if there's any doubt as to the importance of this activity in the view of the rulers themselves, just recall that the res gestae divi Augusti, the achievements of the divine Augustus, are expressly described on the stone as the achievements and expenses of the divine Augustus, and large tracts of that particular inscription are devoted to Augustus, explaining the amounts of money that he spent from his own fisc
to decorate temples and to build buildings and to put on games of all sorts and entertainments, the commoda for the populace. And emperors after Augustus continued perpetually throughout the Roman Empire to provide these sorts of entertainments for the people. Their activity was also replicated all around the empire at the local level by the local decurions and equestrians of the local nobility who put on all kinds of spectacles and entertainments for the crowd. And as I've said in the last lecture, it was the cities that provided the context for the staging of these various entertainments and the provision of these various commoda conveniences. I mentioned some of the more common forms in the last lecture. It might just be worth recapping them. Cash handouts, public banquets, and the provision of buildings for entertainment and leisure. It would be too much to go over all of these possibilities, but we could mention perhaps the presence of theatres, which are found all around in both the Greek East and the Roman West, and the Latin West, as it's sometimes called. Theatres, of course, for the staging of plays, and sometimes for the staging of more violent spectacles. It was possible to hold beast hunts and gladiatorial spectacles in theatres as well. And sometimes also we find small roofed theatres called odeons, which are places where apparently poetry recitals were staged. But the Roman tastes in entertainment were somewhat more crass than that, and the more popular forms of mass entertainment in the Roman world were chariot racing and gladiatorial games. I want to examine in this lecture chariot racing, and in the next lecture I'll devote entirely to the gladiatorial games. But in this one I want to look at chariot racing, and before looking at that, look at an extremely popular form of public leisure, and one that was sponsored in no small way by benefactors the Roman world over, and that is the habit of public bathing, the taking of public baths. The public baths were, in many ways, symbols, even emblems of Roman civilization itself. And they were invariably located in towns and cities around the empire. This was one of the chief amenities that was available in the towns. We do have some baths in rustic settings, but that issue has yet to be investigated. Of course, they're harder to locate when they're isolated out in the countryside. But it does seem that the provision of public bathing, especially if it's to be done in any kind of style, was associated also with city life. In fact, some advertisements for bathhouses state explicitly that here's a bath that has all the conveniences available in which you can bathe in more urbico, in the manner of the city. So it does seem as if the having a proper bath, having a really enjoyable and classy bath, was associated with the towns. Public baths are of rather obscure origin. We do know that the Greeks had public baths in their cities, but they weren't nearly as popular as the Romans, as the Roman form of bath became among the Romans of the late Republic and early Empire. Possibly the baths emerged in the area around Campania, where there are some natural hot springs and the like, but the whole issue of the origins of the Roman public bathing habit is highly debated, and not one that I wish to spend much time on. They do seem to have emerged as an architectural form by the end of the 3rd century BC. By the time of around 200 BC, one of our first Latin writers, Plautus, who was writing plays, refers to public baths in his plays when his characters go and visit the baths and have their clothes robbed out of the baths and so on. So it does seem to be that they're a feature of Roman life by 200 BC. They grew enormously in popularity and considerably as well in architectural complexity in the course of the late Republic in the 1st century BC. And then with the emperors in Rome, when they began to sponsor the building of public baths, then started the real heyday of the habit. And larger establishments were built at Rome, and new standards were set for what was expected of a public bath in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD. The popularity of the habit is manifested in the physical distribution of Roman public baths, because they're found in every possible type of Roman settlement. They're found in hamlets and villages, they're found attached to country villas, they're found, of course, in profusion, usually multiple sets in any city or town that has any pretensions to status at all. They're found as well attached to forts and fortresses for the use of the soldiers, and places like Hadrian's Wall and elsewhere, it's quite common to find a bathhouse either in or just outside the fort for the use of the soldiers and the community that might be growing up outside the fort.
And even in one remarkable case, there seems to have been a wooden bathhouse located near a temporary marching camp in Holland, which would be a real testament to the popularity of the baths. Rather than just use the streams or whatever nearby, they would nonetheless build a wooden bathhouse. Would be quite dangerous considering that the baths were heated with fire and so on below. Quite a fire risk there. But the evidence does seem quite strong that at this site in Holland, a place called Velsen, that there was actually a wooden bathhouse outside a temporary fort built there in the period of the Emperor Tiberius. So the physical ubiquity of the bathhouse is clear testament to the popularity of the habit. The designs of Roman baths are very flexible. They show a remarkable degree of variation in terms of the arrangement of the rooms and so forth, but they all basically serve the same practice. It's just a matter of the way that the rooms are physically arranged with respect to each other that differs so much, but the Romans used the baths in much the same sort of way the empire over. There are really two chief characteristics of the Roman bathhouse that reflect, of course, the way that the buildings were used. This is another feature of baths, by the way, that makes them so interesting to study and look at, is that they are at once architectural entities, but they have a very definite function, the traceable function that we can look at by using the literary evidence and see exactly how these buildings were used and then try and match the written and the physical evidence together. And it makes the study of bathing, which has become very popular recently among scholars, a very interesting endeavor indeed. Anyhow, the chief characteristics of the Roman bath is that there would be a sequence of heated rooms, variously heated rooms, through which the bather is channeled in a definite order. There must be a clear sequence of rooms. The rooms won't be in a haphazard arrangement. There will be clearly identifiable sequence of rooms, usually a cold room, a medium hot room called a tepidarium, and a hot room called a caldarium. Sometimes an extremely hot room, a sweat chamber as well could be added if that was required. But you will generally have a clear sequence of rooms, minimum three, cold, medium hot, and hot. But sometimes, of course, much more than that if it's a big and elaborate bathhouse. The other cardinal characteristic of the Roman bath is that there will be communal pools. The Romans used communally heated water, so they would sit together, sort of like the California hot tub type model, using the baths together. This differs, say, considerably from the Greek public bathing habit, which, although it was communal of a sort, was actually conducted in individual tubs. Small little hip baths are called. You sit down in them and have slave come and pour water over you. And although they are arranged openly along the inside wall of a room, so there's a communal element to it, each person is bathing in their own tub. Well, in the Roman bathhouse, the bathers shared the same water and they sat together in the same heated pool. So the clear sequence of rooms and the heated communal pool used by the bathers together, they're the characteristics of the Roman bathhouse, the truly defining characteristics of the Roman bath. And a series of ancillary services could also be provided. You could, as I say, extra heated rooms, especially superheated rooms. There could be exterior pools for people to loll about outside under the sky. You could have extra changing rooms. There could be rooms for oiling, rooms for scraping off, rooms for exercise, rooms for massage. There might also be rooms that served baser functions attached to Roman bathhouses. So a series of ancillary functions came to be associated with the bath, but always, 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 you're going to find a clear sequence of rooms and communally heated pools. They'll always be the characteristics of the Roman bath. In terms of a visit to the bathhouse, it was an extremely entertaining way to spend one's day. It was a complex ritual. It would require several hours to complete it if you were to do it completely, do it in full. And it was almost destined to be a sociable event. You would go into the bathhouse. If you were affluent, you would show up with your slaves and your clients and attendants behind you. And you would, of course, first of all, divest yourself of your clothes. And then you would be oiled with olive oil, rubbed down with olive oil, greased up, if you like. And then you would go outside. If it was a big establishment, there would certainly be an exercise yard of some sort. This is a Greek influence on the Roman bath. But you'd go outside and then you could conduct exercises. You might play ball. You might wrestle, if you were that way inclined. You might fight against a wooden stake with a sword, or you could roll a hoop. But ball games seem to be about the most popular, various types of ball games. We have the names of them. We can't figure out the rules, but we know that basically it involved usually throwing and catching balls of different weights and sizes. That way then you would work up something of a sweat, open the pores, and then you would go inside into the bathhouse, into the medium hot room where
Often, at that point, you would undergo a process called striduling, which is a rather odd and strange practice by our standards, but took place every day thousands of times around the Roman world. A stridula is sort of a curved, like an elongated spoon, and this was used by a slave to scrape off the accumulated sweat and oil and now dust and dirt that would have got on you from the exercise yard, scrape off the body, and what happened to the product of that is something I'll talk about in a minute. But you would be scraped off, usually by one of your attendants, or if you couldn't afford one, by a slave. And then you would go into the hot room, the hottest room of the bath, where you would relax for a while and get quite sweaty, use the heated pool with your friends. You might have a drink of wine, maybe a snack during this process. You would gossip and chat. And then you would go back out of the hot room once you'd finished your ablutions, come back out of the hot room into the medium hot room to relax and get acclimatized to the change of temperature, and then into the cold room, where often there'd be cold plunge pools for you to use to close up your pores. Or you might prefer to go outside into the swimming pool if there was one outside, a lolling pool out in the open air, maybe to watch people exercise. And all the time you would be accompanied by your friends and the people that you wanted to meet at the baths. You would be having snacks and drinks. We know that they had sausages, nuts and bread, and would drink wine. Some people, it seems, had to be carried out of the bath having had far too much wine, but that wasn't, of course, for everyone. And basically you could spend the best part of your afternoon, from about noon till 4 o'clock, in the bathhouse, if that was your want. Of course, if you're in a hurry, you could cut out any number of those particular procedures and have a stripped-down bath. But even then, it would probably take you the best part of an hour to get through even the basic bathing ritual. So the whole procedure then, a very interesting and relaxing one, and highly sociable. All the time, the sociability has to be stressed, because the baths very, very quickly emerge as nodes of community spirit and sociability. They're social centres. One gets the impression that, in fact, by the height of the bathing habit in the 2nd century AD and onwards, the act of getting clean is secondary to going to the bath to meet with your friends. We know, for instance, that dinner parties would generally meet in the bath beforehand. They'd say, right, you know, come to my house, but we'll meet in the public bath nearby beforehand, have a bath together, and then go back to my house for dinner. So the socializing aspect of the bath is an absolutely central feature of the whole experience. The visits to the baths raise all kinds of interesting questions. Did men and women bathe together? I always get asked that question, do they bathe together? And the answer is, well, it depends. In some places they did, in some places they didn't. Some of the bathhouses we have, some of the early ones, for instance, from Pompeii, the Stabian baths at Pompeii, for instance, dating to about 120, or perhaps a little bit earlier, 140 BC, those baths have two separate bathing wings. And in fact, one of them, over the entrance to one of them, was located an inscription that says clearly that that half was for women. So there could be bathhouses that had sections for men and sections for women. We also have some inscriptions that indicate that separate times could be dictated. Women could use the baths in the morning, and then after a certain hour, the baths were reserved for the men. In fact, that sort of habit still goes on in, say, the use of the Islamic hammam in a country like Tunisia, where while the men are working, the women can use the bath, and then once the men's working hours stop, then the bath changes and it becomes a man's bath only. But we also have plenty of evidence to indicate that men and women did in fact bathe together, and practically naked, if not fully naked. So the answer seems to be, to the question, did men and women bathe together? Well, the answer is, it depends. It depends on local tastes and personal tastes and proclivities. It seems that there would be bathhouses where people could go to bathe with the other gender, and also places that one could go where you could avoid that if you so wished. How hygienic were the baths? This is also another question. Well, all kinds of interesting issues that I'd love to get into in detail, but we don't have the time. If I return to the issue of striduling, what happened to the conglomerate of sweat and oil and dirt that was striduled off people inside, remember, inside the tepidarium? This substance, wonderfully called, in Greek, called gloios. What a sound that almost captures the texture, gloios. Well, this substance was just basically flicked onto the walls and floors of bathhouses, and we hear of doctors, for instance, who would go into a bathhouse and collect gloios for use as a binding agent in medical unguents. Not is an ointment I'd wish to put on, but nonetheless, it seems to have been relatively easy to collect. How often was the water changed? We don't know that. Could remember the baths were used communally. We hear as well that plenty of sick people, people with fevers and all kinds of illnesses, would go to the baths. doctors and medical writers regularly recommend bathing as a panacea for all kinds of illnesses and as a good preventative measure to maintain health before one gets ill. And for most people who didn't have a bathhouse in their private dwellings, and most Romans didn't, then if you're to follow the doctor's orders, you have to go to the local public bath. And again, plenty of evidence tells us that people, ill people, were to be found using the baths as well. So to what degree the baths were breeding grounds, wonderful breeding grounds for microbes of all sorts, that's a matter that we'd love to investigate, but unfortunately we don't have the data available to do it. So they may have been rather less than hygienic than people might today might want to think, but I suppose the argument could be that half a bath is really better than no bath at all. And the Romans themselves considered and associated the habit of bathing with cleanliness and getting clean rather than with having a disgusting experience. All the classes did, it seemed, bathe together at the same time, making the baths a rather interesting social environment, although I doubt that the upper classes would have divested their dignitas, their personal status, at the door along with their cloaks. Rather, they would display their status in the midst of the masses through the retinue of slaves they had with them, the quality of the ointments that they used and the oils that they had, the sort of wine that they drank, having woolen rather than linen towels, and so on and so forth. So they could display their status inside the bathhouse directly in a very intimate way in the presence of the masses. And it does seem that slaves could also even use the bath, which is a very interesting feature, but again, one that's open to a certain amount of debate, since limitations on movement would have been one of the chief drawbacks of being a slave. One couldn't just say, listen, I'm going out for a bath today. Perhaps only favoured slaves, slaves in the very privileged position in the slave hierarchy would have had a chance to go out on anything like a regular basis and use public facilities. But the evidence is there that slaves could be found at the baths as customers. When the emperors got involved in patronising the baths, it's a clear sign of the importance of the habit that the emperors do patronise the habit, and they start erecting baths on a scale that staggers the imagination. The baths of Caracalla at Rome cover some 27 acres of land. They have dozens and dozens of rooms. They have their own aqueduct to feed them. They could hold, perhaps, at any one time, as many as 10,000 bathers. And they were places of enormous social entertainment. Not only did you have your bathing rooms and your open-air swimming pools, a vast open-air pool in that case, but the whole bath complex was enclosed in gardens and parks and shops and porticos and even a sort of a large gymnastic complex at one end, and the whole thing was a place of entertainment and relaxation. And similarly for the baths of Diocletian in Rome, the largest set of baths ever built and still preserved very well in the centre of Rome at the Basilica Santa Maria degli Angeli. These covered almost 30 acres of land, and the central cold room with its magnificent Roman cross vault still standing over 120 feet off the ground. It's a sight well worth seeing. And when you go in there, if you ever get a chance, just remember this is just one room of this once enormous facility. So the public bath then definitely a locus of public leisure and one that was patronised by not just the emperors but by any number of local officials, as inscriptions tell us, all around the empire in all sorts of Roman settlements. I should also mention, of course, that there could be smaller bathhouses, sort of neighbourhood corner bathhouses, to be used by people, and they would often be run as businesses by individuals who would gain their living from charging for the amenities and the various services that would be available in the bathhouse. Turning now to the mass entertainment, the first of our two focuses on mass entertainment, chariot racing. This was the most popular of the mass entertainment, the stage spectacles, as opposed to the everyday leisure of the public bath. The chariot racing has a long heritage going back into the Greek past. Chariot racing was a feature, for instance, of the heroes' games, funeral games in Homer, and was also a feature of the ancient Greek Olympic Games. But the Romans, in their inimitable fashion, took this habit and turned it into a mass entertainment. They staged their games in circuses. That's the specific arena for the staging of chariot races. A circus is a bullet-shaped type of an arena, and the largest one in the Roman world was the Circus Maximus in Rome itself, meaning Circus Maximus being the biggest circus, the greatest circus.
It was an enormous structure standing four stories in height, half a Roman mile down each side, with a central spine, sort of a large spine up the center of the racing arena where the chariots raced around. And it had, it could seat, so we hear, something in the region of 200,000 people, which would make it the largest sporting arena ever erected anywhere so far in human history. The chariot races were immensely popular. We hear that the city would be virtually deserted when they would take place. And generally the format would be to have 12 chariots racing, because the chariots raced in teams. There were four teams. They're often called factions. The teams were identified by their colours, blue, green, red and white. And it seems that the fans followed the team colour more than they followed the individual drivers or horses. So in a way, not unlike, I suppose, modern sports people, especially in England, soccer fans will follow the particular team rather than individual people. So if you had 12 chariots racing, that would mean that you would have three chariots from each team, would be fielded for a typical race. Each chariot, the normal number was to have four horses. But we do hear of two horse chariots and even six horse chariots racing on occasion, but they were quite rare. Imagine trying to control six galloping horses. Trying to control four is hard enough, but six would be really stretching it. And they would come out, they would break out of the starting gates at the one end, and to be sure, in the Circus Maximus, there are 12 starting gates. And they would break out in their team colours, the drivers wrapped up in leather and with their team colours on, and they would do the circuit of the circus seven times. Seven laps were required to complete the race. The most popular seats were at the curved end of the bullet shape of the arena, since that's where most of the crashes took place. The slang for a chariot crash in Roman times was a shipwreck. So they like to watch the naufragia, the shipwrecks, tangled masses of horses and drivers and wood that would careen off the corner. And of course, rules were pretty much minimal. You could whip and lash your opponents and try and pull them out of their chariots if you wished, whatever it took. So these are violent spectacles, not just spectacles of skill and entertainment. They're highly violent as well. The races, the laps were marked after the time of Augustus with little golden dolphins that were tipped as each lap was finished, and betting would have been rife. This would have been one of the chief advantages and pleasures of going along would be to bet on teams or on individual drivers. The enormous popularity of the games is reflected in several sources, not least the likes of Juvenal, who writes, for instance, "All of Rome is in the circus today." In one occasion, the whole Circus Maximus chock full of people. We hear that the streets were so deserted whenever the circus races were on that Augustus took to stationing bodies of soldiers at various points around the city to prevent looting and other ruffians from taking advantage of the practically deserted streets during the chariot racing. The poet Ovid gives a very entertaining account of a visit to the races, where he goes not so much to look at the chariots, but to look at the girls, and he's trying to pick them up by being Mr. Charming as they're being jostled by the crowd. The whole sense of his poem about this visit is the packed nature of the crowd and excitement of the whole occasion. Then he's, of course, trying to be Mr. Charming, the knight in shining armour, the girl who's been jostled around, and it's all a ploy on his part, ultimately. And we also hear from inscriptions of the enormous popularity of individual charioteers who could become the likes of superstars for their day. By far the most famous and successful charioteer that we know about raced during the reigns of the emperors Hadrian and Antoninus Pius in the mid-second century AD. His name was Gaius Apuleius Diocles, and we have his gravestone, in which he claims that he raced for 24 years, mostly for the red faction, and he won almost 35% of his races, placed second in a further 33%, which is an extremely impressive record, and only failed to place in 32% of his races. So he was an immensely popular and very wealthy man on his death. Another charioteer mentioned in our sources was a young man called Scorpus, who seemed to be having a great career ahead of him for the green faction, when unfortunately he crashed into the finishing post at the end of the first century AD, and his career came to a swift end at that point. All kinds of underhand stories are told of charioteers poisoning other charioteers, or trying to poison their horses so as they wouldn't perform well the next day. And the support, the fanatical support of the mob for their individual factions is commented on again and again in the sources. We hear, for instance, in AD 390 that one charioteer from one of the factions in a place called Thessalonica over in Greece made a homosexual advance on a Roman general in the area and was ordered to be arrested. When this word got out, the supporters of his faction rioted, lynched the general concerned, broke their charioteer out of jail, and then continued to riot and burn down the centre of the city of Thessalonica, requiring the emperor to send in the troops, with the result that 7,000 people were killed in the ensuing chaos. So the support of the charioteers for their faction was extremely noticeable. And perhaps I might end with this wonderful curse that survives from an inscription in which a person who obviously hates the green and white factions calls down the following curse upon their horses and drivers. Curse reads, "I call upon you, O demon, whoever you are, to ask that from this hour, from this day, from this moment, you torture and kill the horses of the green and white factions, and that you kill and crush completely the drivers Clarus, Felix, Primulus, and Romanus, and that you leave not a breath in their bodies." So much was the fanatical support of the charioteer supporter.
Lecture 43, Public Entertainment, Part 2, Gladiatorial Games.
Hello and welcome to the 43rd lecture in our series on the history of ancient Rome, in which we're going to examine the gladiatorial games, certainly a feature of ancient Roman society that sticks in the popular image and has proven to be perplexing for modern scholars to explain the phenomenon of the games. How can such an urbane and sophisticated society have taken such pleasure in base bloody butchery and mass slaughter in the arena on a regular basis? I'll turn to the various explanations that have been proffered by modern scholars to explain the phenomenon of the games later in the lecture. But I want to discuss the nature of the games themselves, the origins and development of the games over the course of Roman history, and then analyse what the games were like, what sort of spectacles took place, who put them on, what it was like to put them on, what was it like to visit and watch the games first. The Colosseum in Rome has stood now for almost 2,000 years as a symbol not just of the city of Rome but of the ancient civilization that produced it. It has generally evinced wonder and appreciation from those people who have visited. It really is a remarkable site to visit, and it's not hard to see why. It stands some 170 feet high. It's 205 yards by 170 yards on its axes. 130,000 cubic yards of cut stone was used in its erection, along with tens of thousands of tons of concrete. 300 tons of iron alone was used to clasp the cut stone blocks together. There are some 76 entrances into the building, each of them numbered, so as the people coming to the games could be channeled efficiently, quickly to and from their seats in the arena. And the capacity overall is estimated anywhere between 45 and 55,000 people. So a very substantial type of an arena, and a remarkable testament in many ways in its appearance and in its construction to Roman love of scale, beauty, and proportion. But its function as an arena, as an amphitheatre, for the staging of gladiatorial games, which were, in essence, spectacles of almost unimaginable brutality and violence, reflects a somewhat different side of the Roman character, which is what I would like to focus on for most of this lecture. The gladiator remains in the modern popular imagination as a symbol of ancient Rome, and in many ways it's a just symbol, since this was one of the more popular of all of the Roman entertainments. The chariot races were slightly more popular than the games, but the games came in definitely a close second. Gladiators, it seems, came to Rome sometime in the mid-3rd century BC. Their the origins of them before that, where they emerged before that, was it among the Etruscans or among the South Italians, is debated by scholars. But the best evidence so far would suggest that the gladiator was a Italic phenomenon, something that had happened in pre-Roman Italy, probably in the area of Lucania and Campania in South Italy, where some of the first and earliest depictions of gladiators are to be found in the burials of warriors down there, painted onto the inside of tombs for warriors in the south of Italy. We know from the literary evidence that the first gladiatorial display in Rome took place in 264 BC and was in fact a series of fights by four pairs of slaves outside the grave of a prominent Roman nobleman in honour of the memory of that nobleman. And that would link nicely with the supposed origin of the games in a warrior funerary context in South Italy. In fact, for much of their history, the presentation of gladiatorial games was associated with a funerary context and with funerals and either commemorating a person recently dead or one who had been dead for some time. In the case of the late Republic, especially as the competition among the Roman oligarchy became more heated, the games came to be used increasingly as a means of marshalling popular support for individuals' political careers. And so over the course of the second and first centuries BC, the scale of the games increased dramatically. We hear already that as early as 216 BC, a three-day set of funeral games for a prominent Roman nobleman featured 22 pairs of gladiators. Remember, the first display was in 264 BC and had only four pairs, so we've already increased the number by 216 BC. 16 years later, in 200, 25 pairs of gladiators fought in the spectacle. 17 years after that, in 183 BC, 60 pairs fought. And by 174 BC, now with the Roman Empire extending itself across the Mediterranean, 74 pairs of gladiators fought in the course of a three-day spectacle in the city. So already in the second century, the scale of the games is increasing, and in the course of the first century BC, that picks up even further. We've already seen in earlier lectures how both Pompey and Caesar staged games of great spectacle and scale during their periods of prominence in Rome. And then with the emperors, the situation got even more luxurious and extravagant. The main reason for this development, before we look at the imperial games, the main reason for the development of the games in this way is that unlike most other public entertainment, the gladiatorial games were staged not by the Senate and by the public authorities out of the expense of the public fisc, but rather they were staged by individuals at personal expense. So it was a chance for an individual to display wealth and to display extravagance in the ergotistic way towards the people by providing them with entertainment. So as a result, the person who put the games on, the person was called an editor, one who put on games, could, for the duration of the games, become immensely popular with the mob. And this is why, more than anything else, the games were a focus of attention of aspiring politicians and then eventually of emperors, because it was a way for them to stage games. In fact, when one was an aedile in the Republic, this was the time when one was expected to put on games. So it almost became fashionable, almost became a regular feature of going up the cursus honorum in the Roman Republican system to stage games when you were an aedile. And because the competition was involved in Roman politics, then those games got increasingly more lavish and extravagant. The emperors, of course, took over the role when they came to power, and gradually the games got increasingly more extravagant as emperors competed almost with the memory of previous emperors' achievements in the games. I could list numerous examples, but suffice it to say, for instance, that when the Emperor Trajan was celebrating triumphs over the Dacians, the people of modern-day Romania, in AD 107, he put on games that lasted 123 days and saw the killing of over 11,000 animals and 10,000 pairs of gladiators fighting over that time. So there's games that last for 4 months. So we can see that the scale of the games and their duration increases over time. All across the municipalities and townships of the empire, games would also have been staged by local aristocrats competing for positions of prominence in their communities. And we have various examples of advertisements for games from around the empire. This one, for instance, from Pompeii, painted on the wall, states, quote, 20 pairs of gladiators sponsored by Decimus Lucretius Satrius Valens, lifetime priest of Nero Caesar, and 10 pairs of gladiators sponsored by Decimus Lucretius Valens, his son, will fight in Pompeii on April the 8th through the 12th. There will also be a suitable wild animal hunt. The awning will be used. The awning refers to the temporary roof arrangement that was stretched over an arena to help keep the sun off the crowd when it was enjoying the spectacles, because it could get very hot. It must have also gotten rather tense and noisy, and the smell of blood and animals and so forth must have been quite intense in the arena. So the awning was designed sometimes to keep the weather from affecting the crowd's enjoyment of the games. That's what the reference was at the end of that inscription. If we turn our attention now to the games themselves,